Gary, and I have only one job tonight, and that is to introduce Henry Fortunato. And most of you know Henry is our Director of Public Affairs, but I just want to tell you one thing about what's going on tonight. This is the Kansas City version, the Kansas City area libraries, metro area libraries version of the NEA's Big Read, and the NEA has never seen a Big Read like this across state lines, corporate edition with large institutions and small institutions with their book clubs that have everybody from the janitor to the CEO reading. You all know what a great book this is and what a great author Tobias Wolff is, but I hope you know that what the Kansas City libraries have done here over the last couple of months and tonight is a great thing. It hasn't happened before in the United States. And thank you, Henry. The applause doesn't count in my 25 seconds. And there's one guy responsible for this. He's been working for a year to do this, and he's really done it beautifully. And so I just want to salute for the library, but I hope you will also salute Henry Fortunato, who made this happen.
Thanks, Crosby. Thanks very much. And there goes pages 2 and 3 of my remarks. Actually, a lot of people who are responsible for this, and I'm probably the least of them, but we'll get to that in a minute. First, Crosby didn't tell you this, but really we want to welcome you to tonight's seminar on how plagiarism can ruin your life. Those of you who successfully publish a plagiarized short story in a magazine of your choice will receive 3 continuing education credits from a diploma mill in North Korea. Actually, as Crosby indicated, this is quite a night for the libraries of Greater Kansas City. And if you'll indulge me for just a few moments, I want to give you a sense of how all this came about. How did we get here tonight? How did you get here tonight? Believe it or not, almost 18 months ago, we sat down with representatives from Johnson County Library, KCK Library, North Kansas City Library, Olathe Public Library, and Mid-Continent Library, and we said, boy, we need to make the biggest Big Read ever. We need to do a joint application by state, across state lines, 6 library systems. We need to blow the National Endowment for the Arts away with the audacity of our attempt to do something in one KC. So a bunch of us sat around. We looked at some of the books that were available. We spent our Christmas vacations reading 3 or 4 novels that were possible choices. We came back in early January of 2008, really, a year and a half ago. And we sort of sat around and talked about books, and the clear winner was Old School by Tobias Wolff. And so we sat down, and really most of the application work was done by our friends at Johnson County. We applied for the grant. We were notified that we had won. The NEA was so thrilled with this idea that there is now a consortium model available for libraries to work together as a group. So you made that happen by your presence here today. Who else made it happen by their presence here today? I can't name everybody, but there are some people who really worked very, very hard to bring this about. From the Kansas City Public Library, most particularly Paul Smith and Katie Stover, not only are they both redheads, but they love this book, and they have worked their hearts out to make this happen. They deserve a lot of credit. Second, I do want to also point out that our friends at KKFI devoted a lot of time and a lot of airtime to a serial reading of Old School that ran every day, every weekday in April, and hope some of you heard it. We had all kinds of Kansas City celebrities reading chapters. It was a really wonderful sort of community-wide radio experience, which is what KKFI is all about. Also, Donna Pittman from KMBC did quite a bit of work to promote Old School, as did Present Magazine. Crosby mentioned our wrinkle here in Kansas City, the Big Read wrinkle, the Big Read corporate edition. We've had companies, Commerce Bank, the Downtown Council, AIA Kansas City, even the Consulate of Taiwan participated in a reading of Old School. Our approach is you can check out a librarian. We do send a librarian to the company to lead a book discussion group. It's not too late to do it. If your company sounds like you want to do a small reading, 8-10 people is all it takes. Buttonhole me afterwards. I'll give you my card. We can set you up for a Big Read corporate edition. Finally, this has actually become something of a family affair. A couple of weeks ago was a Take Your Child to Work Day. I translated that into Put Your Child to Work Day. My 9-year-old daughter, Victoria, spent several hours collating Big Read pamphlets and bookmarks and audio cassettes, CDs. So we really did live this thing all the way through for quite a few months. If you want a copy of Old School or any of the other Tobias Wolff books, our good friends at Rainy Day are selling them outside, and Tobias Wolff will be signing them afterwards. Okay, time to get to the main event. Tonight, we're going to have an interview with New Letters on the Air with host Angela Elam. This conversation will be re-recorded for later broadcast. Tobias Wolff will discuss Old School and his literary career, including his new short fiction compilation, Our Story Begins, which just a few months ago won the Story Prize. Tobias Wolff is one of the few contemporary writers with an assured spot in American literary history. He won the Penn Faulkner Award for his novel, The Barracks Thief, as well as 3 O. Henry Awards. He leads a graduate-level fiction workshop at Stanford University. His work appears in such magazines as The New Yorker, The Atlantic, and Harper's. This event, I must tell you, is also part of the Bradbury Speaker Series, an event that was established in honor of retired Kansas City Public Library Director Daniel J. Bradbury. Okay, ladies and gentlemen, it's time for a conversation with Tobias Wolff.
Good evening. This is wonderful. Isn't this exciting that we've had all 6 of these library systems come together to do this big read? And I think we should give a round of applause to our librarians and the whole system. Now, I've got a stack of books over here, but one of them, before we get started, Tobias, I hope you don't mind if I steal a little of the time here, but I wanted to point out that New Letters Magazine, and I work for New Letters Magazine, is celebrating the 75th anniversary, which has been around for a while, and we have a brand new double issue out that has our first ever DVD in it. So if you're interested in subscribing, there's some envelopes, some subscription envelopes as you leave the auditorium. Please pick it up, and we'd love to have you read our stories and poems and essays. And actually, May 18th is also the deadline for the awards. So if you have poetry and essays and short stories, you can apply. So, and I want to thank you for coming here tonight. This is so exciting because so many people have read Old School now and are interested in hearing what you have to say about it. But before we do, I've got to get a voice check. I'm getting my assistant producer in the wings is signaling me, Dennis Conroe, so let me move your mic a little bit.
Okay.
Okay. There we go. And why don't we start by having you give the name that you used when you were applying to the prep school that you ended up going to?
You're making me a figure of fun before I even get started here. What did I use? I think the name I put on that application was Tobias Jonathan von Ansel Wolf III. Sounded good.
You were a fiction writer even then.
I wanted, before we go on, to say how happy I am to be here, especially following the amazing exertions of Henry Fortunato and the rest of the library staff and all the people who have contributed to the to this community read of my book. You can only imagine what it would mean for a writer to have so many people take an interest in a book and to devote time to it and meet and talk about it. I mean, it's a writer's dream, really, and I'm really appreciative.
So I take it in your travels with the NEA and going to big reads in other cities, you've done a couple of them. You haven't had one quite like this.
No, nothing this extensive. Absolutely not. No, this is unique.
Okay, great. Congratulations,
you have to have a certain kind of, you have to have a certain kind of community to do this.
Yes, I think that's right. He was asking if we had a strong literary community here. And what do you think? So, I guess what I wanted to know, because you've written 5 collections of short fiction, and then you've written a couple of memoirs that you're really famous for, This Boy's Life and In Pharaoh's Army. Mm-hmm. This Boy's Life about your childhood, and In Pharaoh's Army, your time spent in the Vietnam War. And so I'm wondering, when you were contemplating writing Old School, was there a moment, because there are some incidents that are like your life, mm-hmm. I mean, a lot of it is fictionalized, of course, but was there a moment where you thought, should I write another memoir or should I write a book of fiction? What happened? Where was the problem?
No, I never for a moment considered writing Old School as a memoir. Certainly, I knew before I put the first word down that I was going to draw very deeply from the well of memory and writing it. I couldn't possibly have written this book without doing that. But the conception that I had for the book simply wouldn't have, you know, that amount, that particular time frame that I was using, all of that. The events of my career, though, there was a lot of interior drama going on. There wasn't enough of the kind of, how can I put it? There wasn't enough incident of a kind that created a dramatic pattern, if you will. So I didn't really see the possibility, as I had in writing This Boy's Life and later in Pharaoh's Army, of the actual events did not in themselves make up, I thought, a sufficiently interesting story to write a memoir. Now, of course, it is the style these days to disregard the requirements of things being actually true when you call them a memoir, but I'm stuck and old-fashioned on the idea that when you say that something's a memoir, it really should have happened. Though, you know, there's a lot of fun to be had the other way. My favorite is that French memoirist, Misha de Fonseca, who a couple of years ago published a memoir in which she chronicled her life during World War II. Having been orphaned as a toddler, she toddled into the forest and was adopted by a pack of wolves and raised by the wolves for I guess some time, and you know, I guess they raised her well enough so that she could write a memoir about it later. This story was found not to be true, and people were shocked. This had been widely published and had, I believe, won awards. You know, it did make me scratch my head. I've read a bit. I like wolves a lot. I read a lot of Jack London when I was, in fact, I changed my name to Jack when I was a boy because I liked Jack London so much and went by that name for many years. And then I read Farley Mowat, and then I read Barry Lopez, and I've read a lot about wolves, and nothing that I've read about them inclines me to think that a plump, pink-cheeked little creature wandering into their midst would be regarded with anything but, you know, kind of as a culinary delight.
Well, you've kind of seen the memoir change quite a bit, and I promise I'll get to old school in a second, but when you wrote This Boy's Life back in, what was it, 1989, that's when it was published, at that time, memoirs about everyday people weren't quite as common as they are now. I mean, now it's a really hot genre, basically. Mm-hmm.
I don't know that it's very hot anymore, Angela, because
you think it's cooling off?
Well, I think so, and partly because of the quite understandable skepticism of the reader who's been burned too many times by dramatic stories like that that turned out not to be true. I won't go through the litany. I think we all know them. And anyway, I think, yes, there may have been a little surge of interest for a while there in such memoirs. I'm not sure how enduring that has been. But you're right. When I was writing this memoir, my first memoir, This Boy's Life, I did have actually someone in my publishing firm ask me, actually said, no offense, but why do you think anyone would be interested? And it was a really good question. I mean, I wasn't Graham Greene, who wrote a couple of wonderful memoirs, but for whom there was a prior interest, nor was I Winston Churchill or, General Schwarzkopf or David Niven or the kind of people who wrote memoirs with some guarantee that there would be an interested audience. I was a short story writer at the time, with that vast audience that a short story writer commands in this country, only slightly greater than that of a poet. So it was a good question to have asked, but I, at that point, was, in a sense, resigned to writing it. I'd begun writing it, and I was loving writing it. I mean, sometimes, frankly, most of the time, I find myself, really struggling to bring my material to life and to... In this case, and I found the material really carrying me. I was excited to be writing it, so I didn't really allow myself to entertain that very good question at the time, and I hoped that the book would somehow make its way in the world, and I was surprised, really, that it did as well as it did. And I was not the only one surprised, either. There weren't enough copies in the bookstores when it came out, because they had not anticipated there would be, that kind of interest in it. And
sure.
I was gratified that there was.
Yeah, that's wonderful. Well, tell me about the genesis of Old School when you got started. Because when I was looking over your newest book, which is a collection of new and selected stories, it's called Our Story Begins. And the very first short story in here that comes from your early collection, In the Garden of North American Martyrs, the two women in this story both teach, and one of them comes to the prep school or to the college
to
interview. And there was something in there that was reminiscent of what happens in the end of Old School with the professor coming to try to get into a different school after he had left the school that's the subject
matter. After she had left, yes. That's
and so
right.
I was wondering if the beginnings of it go way back, or when did you decide to start working on this as a novel, Old School?
Well, it had been in my mind for a long time to write something about the... I mean, it's hard for me to identify just exactly when all sorts of, currents ran together to produce this, but certainly the major impetus for writing it was the experience that I had of being... Of going quite abruptly from a very kind of vocationally designed rural high school in Washington State to a school where, except for a few scholarship boys like myself, most of the students were quite wealthy and also pretty well educated before they got there, which I was not. And there was a jarring experience in many ways, and one that I contemplated for years afterwards. Just what it's like to move very abruptly from one world to another with different habits of speech and dress and pastimes, hopes, ambitions, all that sort of thing. It was a it really was a very different world, and I experienced it quite suddenly. And it gave me, you know, it had certain effects on me, which I was curious to observe. Somewhat at the time, I could see them happening, but with the gift of time, I could see how those things had affected me. And wanted to write about that, but I was also very interested in the idea of vocation and how we come to decide what we're going to do with our lives, how vocation grows in us. And I was interested in particularly in the as I tend to gravitate toward the question of identity, just how we become the person we're going to be. What part does imagination play in that? We are well accustomed to seeing identity defined as a product either of biology or of upbringing and cultural training. And I have not seen anyone really speak very much about the part that imagination plays in the forming of our identities. And I think it's certainly been my experience in looking back on my life that imagination was a crucial element of formation. And I mean, to the point where I really kind of think we can only be who we can imagine being. It's what defines the reach and limit of the self that we become. So I wanted to write about that, and also I wanted to write about writing. It's my life. It has been my ambition to be a writer since I was, you know, pretty young. So I wanted to write about and competition and friendship and class, all those things that had interested me over the years kind of came together in this book.
It really does. It's interesting, too, because what you've done here, when you said you wanted to write about writing, I love the fact that you've got the three writers embedded, the three famous writers, or I think I've heard you refer to them as your triumvirate, mm-hmm. you know, when you were young, mm-hmm. Robert Frost, and, of course, Ernest Hemingway and Ayn Rand. And to be able to, in a way, put on the mask of those writers and write in their voice within the novel, that had to be just a lot of fun for you because
it was.
They made a presence.
Once I understood what I was going to do, and I knew that those three writers were going to appear in the book, then I did a lot of research. I looked into for example, with Frost, I read the William Pritchard biography and the great long Lawrence Thompson biography, rather an unkind biography, that one. And then I read Frost's letters, and I read reminiscences of him by people he had taught and people he had known. So I read a lot about each of these writers, and I really paid a lot of attention to their letters because I could pick up something of a little more closer to their spontaneous ways of speaking, their habits of thought. And then I just imagined myself as them and put myself in these situations. I didn't lift things that they said. I just tried to become them and to answer and to speak in the situations that I imagined them in. I put them in imaginatively. I did see Frost. He came to my school. But I'm actually rather younger than my narrator, younger than somebody anyway. And so I was sitting in the back of the hall when he was here, and I didn't hear anything he said. But I did notice his affect. He had a kind of theatrical way about him, and pretended to be a little disarmed by modern technology, like a microphone. And you know, this was a guy who gave a reading almost every night of his life. I mean, you know, he loved to play the kind of the kind of backwoods sage who just happened to wander out, you know, to give this particular appearance. Very theatrical. They all three were, actually, Hemingway, Ayn Rand, and Frost. They were all very aware of themselves as characters and how they groomed their images very carefully.
Not unlike the boys at the school.
Absolutely.
Especially the main character who's doing the same thing,
yeah.
Grooming his identity.
Absolutely,
too.
Yes. Yeah. He's making himself into what he thinks of as a kind of proper product of this environment that he has found himself in to fit in. We do that.
Yeah.
We're very good at it when we're young.
Yeah. Well, I think a lot of people keep it up all through their lives. I was talking to someone, a friend of mine, and she said, "I always feel like I'm faking it." And I thought, mm-hmm. "Oh, that's interesting. I wonder how many people feel mm-hmm. that as mm-hmm. they go through mm-hmm. life that they're faking mm-hmm. it."
But what was she referring to?
Actually, it was writing, but I hate to say that. But, you know. Okay. I think I've been derailed here. I guess I did.
It's okay. You didn't use,
that after
you didn't
I
use her name.
After I made you say your made up name there in the beginning. So, well. To go back to what I was asking before, I was curious how long ago did you start Old School? Or were you ruminating on it for a long time and then you sat down? I mean, tell me a little bit about your habits of writing.
Well, I write different things differently. But, yeah, I had been turning that over for a long time. And at first I had conceived of it as a short novel, quite a short novel, a novella, really. And I was just going to have Frost visit the school. And then as I began to think more about it, I realized that all the questions that I wanted to approach in the book, that all these things I've mentioned a little while ago, really couldn't be contained in so short a form, and that was when I realized that other writers were going to make an appearance, and so I used the other writers who had been very influential, the other two who, in different ways, had been seduced my loyalty when I was that age, and not only mine. These writers were iconic, really, and very public figures too. I mean, Frost went to Russia and actually, even in his old age, debated Nikita Khrushchev. He was, of course, the poet who, you know, read at Kennedy's inauguration. And Hemingway, of course, was the best-known writer in the world at that point. And a very glamorous figure, though privately miserable. Ayn Rand is still popular. When I talk to bookstore owners, when I visit bookstores, I like to ask about Ayn Rand's work, and it ticks over. It's very, very popular still, generally with the young. And she was, everybody I knew had read her when I was her age, and her ideas had great appeal. They, I think, tend to have a little less appeal for most of us as we get older, but. Because they're simple answers to very complicated questions that she gives us, but nevertheless, very commanding, very powerful, very confident. She testified in front of Congress about the dangers of collectivism, that kind of thing.
Right. Yeah. But what I admire is that you chose three writers that didn't just appeal to you when you were young, but they couldn't be any more different from mm-hmm. each other, really.
That's true.
Even though they were all such public figures.
Absolutely.
So that was kind of neat. There was something, because you learn a little bit about writing throughout this, as you can see, this is what I do. I mark tons of things that are impossible to get to, but the thing that I thought was interesting was that the main character sits, and I've actually had, I wish I could remember the writer that I interviewed. He said, it was a guy, and it may come to me as we talk, but he was he would get his young students to actually write some famous writer's work, that by slowing down and writing it longhand, that would teach them to really appreciate it in a different way than simply reading it. Mm-hmm. And so it was kind of interesting that that's the ploy that the main character uses, but eventually it leads him to plagiarism. And yeah. So you play with this whole notion of that whole idea that copying someone is yeah. flattery. It's a good yeah. thing, but then you cross this line.
Yeah, the young man is definitely softened up by this. It becomes a little more comprehensible, I think, an act, because he has been kind of doing it with these Hemingway stories just to get himself immersed in the structure of those sentences and the rhythms and what it feels like to write them. And so when he does come to doing this thing, which so undoes him, I think it's maybe a little more comprehensible how that happens than if there had been none of that before, if he just sat down and baldly wrote out this story. But he's kind of been used to doing that in a benign way. And it's we learn everything by imitation. And at a certain point, you know, he stepped over. And we understand from this absolute adoration of Hemingway how much this means to him, how much it would mean to him to be able to enter the presence, you know, receive this papal audience. And he doesn't even recognize how much that means to him. He's not, like most of us, not aware of some of the deepest stirrings of his desires here at that moment.
Well, he's still so young. Which I think that you captured that well, too. You know, he's still not quite developed. That's what's going on with him at that time. Mm-hmm. You know, he struggled so much to write a story for Hemingway to be able to give him. Mm-hmm. And I read somewhere that when you sit down to write in the very beginning, that the initial getting it out is a tough thing for you, and it's the rewriting that you actually love as a writer.
Yeah, getting it out is the hard part for me, getting it down. I always begin a story or a book with a terrible feeling of anxiety, really, that it isn't worth it, or that I'm not going to be able to finish it, or really, that's the great anxiety, that there's nothing there, really, that I've been fooling myself. And, you know, like your friend, I sometimes feel like I've been impersonating a writer, and now my bluff is called, and I've got to write a book or a story. That first process for me is difficult. I wish it weren't. After I get a nice hunk of story down, a draft tends to be much longer than what I end up with. But once I get it down, then I really enter into the process with a lot of joy. I love rewriting because the anxiety's gone, and then it's the artistry of my calling that I'm responsible to. And I just love shaping things. I love working with language. It's the kind of clay that I work with. When it's down there, I can kind of walk around with it, and I don't feel any embarrassed, you know, any hesitation to throw a lot out and then put some more back. And, you know, it's that whole, it's probably what other writers do in their heads before it's on the page. And I do it after it's on the page. I mean, I can't imagine, for all the books that he wrote, that Updike really did all that. I mean, because he wouldn't have had time. And he just wrote really good drafts, I think, really. I mean, I know he did rewrite. I know he did rewrite a little bit, but it didn't. And I've seen manuscript facsimiles of Chekhov's short stories. He's my favorite short story writer. I just
I love him.
I just love
his
stories.
Well, maybe next to
you. Oh, thank you. No, you're allowed to like Chekhov more. I do. Anyway, you know, and Chekhov wrote really good first drafts. I think he did a lot. I mean, he wrote over, I mean, we have in English over 500 of his stories. That's a lot. And there are more that haven't been translated. So he wrote quickly, but he was a brilliant guy and could, I think, could write a lot in his head before he actually put it down. I mean, one of his most famous stories, The Grasshopper, was written in an afternoon while he was sitting on the edge of a pond watching some friends bathe. And, you know, he was incredible that way. But I know, you know, for the polish of those stories that a lot of that was going on up here.
I've seen that with different writers, that they have it ruminating in their heads for quite a while, and they're telling it already before they commit anything to paper.
Yeah.
It's just a
everybody
different way
works
of
differently. There's mm-hmm. no one way of writing. There are as many different ways of writing a book as there are writers. I'm always fascinated when I read the Writers at Work interviews in the Paris Review at the different methods that the writers describe.
Well, tell us a little bit about your method. Are you one of these people who gets up every morning and starts writing, or do
when
you...
I'm on a book, I do I try to observe a pretty good schedule. I do find that if you're very, very rigid about your schedule and you are thrown by life as you are going to be, that it can crack your sense of discipline more severely than if you keep a little looser hand on the reins and try to adapt to, you know, what life throws at you. I mean, we've had three children, and I've been very involved in their raising. I've taught full-time until quite recently, and I've on a somewhat reduced teaching schedule now. But, you know, the car needs an oil change now and then. Your shoes wear out. You need to pick up somebody at soccer practice. And, you know, you just do those things. And so if you can't say, oh, but I have to write till 2:30. No, I mean, you go pick the kid up. And so you learn to, you know, to have a little bit of, you know, you become a little more liquid in your approach to the whole enterprise.
Do you find it's hard teaching writing? Because I know you've taught creative writing at Stanford. Does that pull away from your own writing? Do you find there are periods where you're focused on other people's writing and it's difficult to focus on your own, or did the two work? Did one rejuvenate you somehow? Or
I don't know what effect teaching has had on my writing. I have no idea. There would have to be two of me. So, you know, really, I'm not being facetious. I just don't know if I'd had a control who just wrote, you know, and then I'd know. But I've felt pretty lucky in my teaching. For one thing, I like talking about books. I like conversation about books. I grew up without anybody ever talking about books, and when I came into a life where those things mattered, it was a tremendous tonic to me, and very encouraging that to be around people for whom this mattered. The world at large, for the world at large, it doesn't much matter, I think. And so I like to live in this totally artificial environment, this hothouse where, you know, where us precious people who love books can talk about them, and teaching gives me that. I teach a great books course every fall to 250 incoming freshmen. I just love doing that, introducing my students to Catherine Ann Porter and to Melville and James Baldwin and Isaac Dinesen and Tolstoy and Chekhov, and I like teaching a workshop to really, you know, really good young writers, and I can't think it hurts too much.
apparently
I think I'd
not.
Go crazy with boredom if I wasn't doing something like that.
Yeah. Well, there's a little section that talks about the life of a writer. It's towards the end of the book, and I thought I would just have you read this. It begins right here. I made a pencil mark, and then goes to the end of that
to the
section.
Break? Yeah. To the break?
To the break.
Okay.
It's kind of mid-paragraph, but it's odd to start it right at the top.
For a writer, there is no such thing as an exemplary life. It's a fact that certain writers do good work at the bottom of a bottle. The outlaws generally write as well as the bankers, though more briefly. Some writers flourish like opportunistic weeds by hiding among the citizens, others by toughing it out in one sort of desert or another. The life that produces writing can't be written about. It is a life carried on without the knowledge even of the writer, below the mind's business and noise, in deep unlit shafts where phantom messengers struggle toward us, killing one another along the way. And when a few survivors break through to our attention, they are received as blandly as waiters bringing more coffee. No true account can be given of how or why you became a writer, nor is there any moment of which you can say, "This is when I became a writer." It all gets cobbled together later, more or less sincerely, and after the stories have been repeated, they put on the badge of memory and block all other routes of exploration. There's something to be said for this. It's efficient, and may even provide a homeopathic tincture of the truth. Thank you. Thank you. So having read that, now you know not to trust anything I've said tonight about this whole writing, the growth of this vocation. Well, you know that wonderful, I mean, to speak of Frost has that most misunderstood of all poems about the road not taken. And it's always represented, you know, people use a line from it under their yearbook pictures. I took the road less traveled by, and that has made all the difference, you know. Like this theme of the embrace of difficulty and individuality. But if you actually read the poem, "As for that," this is a line, "as for that, the passing there had warned them really about the same," he says, okay? He looks down one as far as he could, and then the other. "As for that, the passing there had warned them really about the same." So, and then he says, and I love this, he says, "I shall be telling this with a sigh, someday ages and ages hence, how two roads met in a wood, and I took the one less traveled by, and that has made all the difference." Well, what that poem is really about then is not taking the hard or unusually used path, but about how we lie about the choices we've made as we get older. Or not lie, really. It's how it's a poem about the way we glorify or valorize the choices we made when we were young without any sense, really, of their being more difficult than another. But you get to a certain point. And I just love that idea. I should be telling this with a sigh. You can almost see the grandchildren at his feet, you know, and that self-dramatizing. And I took that, and you know, that. And I just love the way he writes about the in that poem about the way we treat the past later on as this kind of theater of our wondrous nature. And when honestly, when you read the beginning, it's really completely arbitrary, the choice he makes. So from these arbitrary choices, without any sense of their consequence, come a pattern of life, which we then in our later years bestow with all the aura of decision and commitment and conviction. It's a wonderful poem, much better than the kind of Hallmark thing, the way it's usually read, you know? Anyway.
That's great. And it, again, deals with identity and this sort of assumption that you've imbued yourself with this identity,
yeah,
in a way.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, that's funny. Yeah, Robert Frost. Boy, I feel like we just had a peek into his English class. What do you think? I better do an ID for our radio audience. By the way, I forgot to tell you, we will post-produce this and air this on New Letters on the Air towards the end of June. And to get the exact date, you can go to newletters.org/radio and check our schedule for when he's going to air. So, and I better do the ID that I've said. I'm talking with Tobias Wolff, who's written the novel Old School, which is part of the Big Read here in Kansas City and has all our libraries involved, and it's an exciting thing for us. One of the other masks that you deal with here has to do with the characters who are Jewish, but not letting it be known necessarily that they have a Jewish heritage or that they are Jewish. Mm-hmm. What made you deal with this mask in particular? I mean, there are all these great scenes. I mean, where we have the main character who's following the guy who takes care of the custodian up the stairs and whistling what he doesn't realize, the young boy, is that horrible song that was the Nazi song, mm-hmm. and how he offends him. And that starts off the whole looking at this Jewishness. What prompted you to deal with that mask?
Well, that was... I
not
mean,
the
that,
mask of Jewishness, but
no,
wearing
no, no, no.
Mask
I understand
the
sort of covering up, really. I had the experience of discovering when I was an adult, not when I was at school, that I was raised by my mother, who was Irish Catholic, and not all that Catholic herself, though she wanted me to be. So she sent me to catechism and all that, and my father, who humphed about Catholicism because he was Episcopalian. It turned out that he wasn't. It turned out that he was Jewish. He came from a Jewish family in Hartford, Connecticut.
So that part of the novel was a fact that you pulled from your own life, because
yes, except it didn't influence my sense of myself when I was at school, because
right.
I didn't know that.
You didn't know it then, yeah.
But I did feel very much an outsider. And I thought that, and in fact, though I really did like my school a lot, I learned a lot, I still give to the school because it gave so much to me. But in the way of a lot of those old WASPy schools, there was a little stream of anti-Semitism at that school that I was aware of there, even though it didn't seemed to affect me, or I never felt it to affect me directly. I was aware of, for example, I'll never forget one night we were in the dining hall, and somebody was saying something about religious ritual and comparing them to one thing or another. And the master, who was at the head of our table, was a very nice guy. A Jewish gentleman of my acquaintance tells me that, and there was something about the way he said that. He would never have said, an Episcopalian gentleman of my acquaintance, or, you know what I mean? There was something funny about it, and there was just that, it was never expressed as hostility or hatred or dislike, or, I mean, it wasn't that kind of thing. There was just a little... There was just a tincture of it, and I remembered it, and I thought, well, this would really, this would dramatize the internal kind of struggle of somebody who feels himself an outsider, as I did, and trying to fit in. So that was a kind of adaptation of the story that I experienced through kind of imagined a different way of approaching that whole question in the novel. But I didn't go through what my narrator goes through in that way.
Sure, because you were much older by the time that you found that out.
Yeah.
Don't you think that most writers see themselves as outsiders in a way? I mean, that I've run across that quite a bit, and that's part of what makes you want to write to begin with, is because you're outside looking at the story, and there's an objectivity there that you see. I would think so.
Yeah, I think if you are completely comfortable within things, within the system that you live in, the impetus to write probably wouldn't be as strong. I think there has to be some kind of face-off there. And often that is produced by, the kind of, when, for example, in his great, great book, The Fire Next Time, you know, James Baldwin writes about his struggles with the whole culture of this country. And it gave him a great kind of rage, which later found a form and a kind of detachment for its expression that made a great artist of him. It would have been hard for me to imagine that kind of fire so beautifully contained in his work had he not experienced that sense to call it injustice doesn't even cover it. I mean, it was so utterly systematic. The regard of a whole group of human beings is somehow less than other human beings. And, it's hard to imagine ourselves back into that situation, but when you experience Baldwin's writing and his, it's even in his prose,
It's powerful. Well, the story within the story, which the young narrator ends up getting him in trouble, and everyone in here has probably read this book, probably a radio audience, maybe not everyone has read it at that point, but...
So don't give it away,
that's what I'm trying to say. But there's a scene out of that book that out of that story that kind of grasp a little bit of what we were just talking about. And I might have you read this if I can find it really quickly. By the way, I think we should let people know. I mean, the things that are real in your book and that are not real, you did not plagiarize, and that's why you got kicked out of the school you were in.
I didn't plagiarize. I don't think I've ever plagiarized anything.
Yeah, so wondering what parts are true, I think it had more to do with mathematics or
it
something
did,
that
yeah,
you had
I
trouble could, with.
I had terrible.
Yeah.
Set theory.
So.
I bear a grudge.
There's this point, and I don't know how much to give away to people who might not have read it, but. There's a scene where Ruth, it's inside the story. Well, actually, maybe I'll have you read it, and then we can, or you can look at it and decide if you want to read it. Are you guys up for hearing him read a little bit more? Okay, good. So this is where the narrator has found the story, and it's from the girls' school. It's a girl who's written it. And so I thought I would have you read that from here to the end. It's a little bit long, but it shouldn't take too terribly long. From the purple mark to the end of the passage.
Okay, this is the girls' school.
Right.
Or the girls' story.
The story, right. Is that giving away too much if people haven't read it?
No, it's okay.
Okay.
So he happens to be reading this literary journal from a girls' school. He's been, meanwhile, somewhat casting about for a story of his own to write without any success. I kept reading. The narrator... I kept reading. The narrator is at a bus stop, heading home after a typing class at the Y. She smokes She's picked up a cigarette butt that someone else has dropped. She smokes the butt while she waits, even when it becomes apparent that another girl has caught her in the act and is completely grossed out. I don't really care, the narrator says, because I don't know her. If I knew her, or if she was a boy, that would be different. As she smokes, she thinks up a lie to scare up some cigarette money from her mother. Another fee for supplies in the typing class. She rides the bus across the city, Columbus, and walks home through a neighborhood of brick apartment buildings. Her mother's apartment is on the third floor. It's sweltering inside. The narrator's little sister is watching TV. Her mother's in her bedroom with a headache. She calls out to the narrator. Ruth, it turns out her name is. And Ruth puts some ice in a dish towel and carries it into the darkened room. She sits on the edge of the bed, holding the ice pack to her mother's forehead, and after making some tender inquiries, slips in the lie about the typing supplies. Her mother sighs and says, "Okay, of course, take what you need." She tells Ruth that two of her friends called, but asks her please not to make any plans as she feels really awful and needs help with Naomi. Ruth goes into the kitchen and looks at the notepad by the phone. The first message is from a girl she grew up with. It's the second time she's called since Ruth got home for the summer, and though Ruth feels guilty for not calling her back, she knows she won't do it this time either. The other message is from Caroline Fallon, a classmate at the boarding school Ruth attends on scholarship. She dials the number immediately. The two girls make clever talk about how bored they are. Ruth calls her mother Maman and describes her indisposition in terms that make Caroline laugh. Then Caroline asks if she'd like to go to a dance at the country club that night. When Ruth hesitates, she apologizes for the late notice and says, by way of explanation, they need girls. "Okay," Ruth says, "I need boys." There's just one thing, Caroline says. It's so ridiculous, but anyway, can I give your name as Lewis instead of Levine? Lewis? You know, Lewis, Logan, something like that. I'm sorry, Ruthie. Club rules. I see. It's disgusting. I probably shouldn't have called you. No, that's all right. That's fine. Tell them Windsor. Windsor, you are a stitch. I mean, Ruthie Windsor. Ruth Ann Windsor. Ruth and her mother argue over her plans for the night, and Ruth handles it so deftly that her mother gets out of bed to coax her back from desolation and take in the waste of a smart old evening gown of her own that Ruth's been coveting. When she leaves the apartment, she has to stop and catch her breath. She's so heady with the relief of escape, like getting out of Granny's hospital room. Then the dance, the convertibles in the parking lot, the Japanese lanterns along the path to the ballroom, the music, the boys. Ruth sees that the boys have noticed her, but the one who catches her notice happens also to be the boy Caroline has in her sights. His name is Coulson. He and his friend Gary sit down at Ruth and Caroline's table. They're both handsome, but Gary's sort of bland, and Coulson's broody and smart. Too smart, really, for Caroline. And just as Ruth feels his interest shift toward her, she senses a growing restlessness in Caroline, a watchful, formless unease. Something's wrong, and Caroline doesn't yet know what it is, but she'll know soon enough if things follow their present course, and she will hate Ruth for it and drop her like a toad. Normally, that wouldn't bother her. Ruth likes to compete with other girls, and she fancies this Coulson with his rumbly voice and hooded eyes. At any other time, she would encourage his attentions. But this isn't any other time. She's at the beginning of a long summer. One of the convertibles in the parking lot belongs to Caroline, And already Ruth has gotten used to being rescued from her hot apartment for breezy drives to movie theaters and the pool at Caroline's house. This is only the first of many dances at the club, and she wants to be invited to the rest. Caroline won't just drop her if she feels betrayed. She will make sure Coulson knows that Ruth is here tonight under false pretenses, and exactly what those pretenses are. How interested will he be then? Lousy odds, Ruth thinks. She fastens her attention on Gary. He warms to it, and Coulson withdraws moodily before resuming his languid banter with Caroline, who comes brightly to life. But Ruth is still aware of Coulson and knows that he's aware of her. Something may yet come of it before this summer is over, something secret where Ruth can get her own back. Even now, the current between them is so obvious to her that she can hardly believe Caroline doesn't feel it. Ruth stands and takes Gary's hand to lead him toward the dance floor. Caroline smiles up at Ruth and lifts her glass. Good. She doesn't know. Everything's okay.
Okay. Oh, that was nice. That's Tobias Wolff reading from Old School, part of the Big Read here in Kansas City, and I'm at the Plaza Library. I'm Angela Elam, and this is for New Letters on the Air. That was so nicely done because there's a little bit more at the beginning, but you can tell he's a master short story on top of being the novelist because we have a full story within the story. I mean, there are all these stories within stories within stories in this book, and I think that's part of what makes it so magical. And you do give us insight into the writer's life on top of it as well. And I know there are a ton of people out here who want to ask you questions, and I promised that I would shut up at some point, and I've probably gone on too long. But I think that we've got a couple of microphones that are over here, and so if you could maybe step up to the microphones, that would be great. And while they're setting that up, I just wanted to thank you.
Thank you, Angela.
You're such a generous soul. I mean, you can really get that from your writing as well, because you really enjoy people, I think, and all the eccentricities involved with them. I mean, I think that's what makes your character so powerful.
Thank you.
Yeah, it really does.
Enjoyed our conversation.
And I hope you'll come back. Who wants to go first? Ah, the guy at the microphone.
Tobias, I really enjoyed your book. Seems like the build-up was towards the Hemingway character towards the end. Can you tell us a little bit about that build-up and the plot device and the narrator involved?
The build-up toward Hemingway, you mean? Well, he was... once I kind of constructed the idea of building the story around these three appearances, Hemingway's would have been the culminating experience because Hemingway just didn't stand for a kind of writing. He stood for a kind of life, and he was most influential on me. And I remember, for example, when I was about 14, Life magazine, remember they used to have these full-sized great pictures on photographs in the back. They had raised that kind of photographic, it's almost like an essay. You could see a life in those photographs to an art form, and published great photographers in the W. Eugene Smith and Karsh, and all these great photographers would appear. And then I remember when I was about 14 or so, seeing on one of those pictures Ernest Hemingway leaving Madison Square Garden with Marlene Dietrich on his arm. And I remember thinking, you know, there are worse things to be than a writer. And I mean, these were one of these moments. And the whole kind of Hemingway story, which one later finds as a grown-up, you find some you know, he was in many ways an unhappy man, constantly trying to prove himself to himself and to everyone else and all that. But he represented something to us boys. And, I mean, we affected laconic ways of speaking to each other that could have come right out of one of his novels. And so that it was important that he be the kind of culminating figure in this series and to give it that kind of rising tension and expectation and to screw the narrator's emotions to a point where he would actually step over a line that if he really could have stepped back and thought what he was doing, he wouldn't have stepped over.
I was looking for that little passage, it's real short, where the students actually did try to talk in
the same way.
Well, let
me see. Maybe I can
find
that.
I thought I'd marked it, but I probably lost that one. It was just really short.
Yeah, this is it's here.
There it is.
I was talking. Yeah, I was writing in here about the debt of a piece of writing that one of the boys has to Hemingway, but that I wouldn't have pointed this out because as I sit right here, I myself was in debt to Hemingway up to my ears. My roommate and I even talked like Hemingway characters, though in travesty, as if to deny our discipleship. That is your bed, and it is a good bed. And you must make it, and you must make it well. Or, today is the day of meatloaf. The meatloaf is swell. It is swell, but when it is gone, the not having meatloaf will be tragic, and the meatloaf man will not come anymore.
Mr. Wolf, I just wanted to say I'm very excited to see you. It's a pleasure to see you, and I'm a big fan. I've been reading your books for about 13 years now. I'm 25 years old. I recently purchased some out in the hall as well. And I just wanted to ask a question. What kind of knowledge do you think you could pass on, or, you know, any kind of advice you'd like to give to upcoming young writers like myself? And I have a brother, but he's not here right now. But, you know, I write a lot of nonfiction as well as fiction, and my brother writes a lot of things for the screen. Mm-hmm. So what kind of advice would you have for someone in my position?
Good. Well, I take it for granted that anyone who wants to be a writer reads a lot. That's the first thing. You just read a lot, and kind of you've got to be marinated in this stuff all the time, you know. And so that's important. But I would take it for granted that if you wanted to be a writer, you would be interested in reading anyway. I guess the best advice I could give that I have learned in my own practice as a writer is if we read a lot, we get a certain standard almost inscribed in us about how good things should be. And the truth is our critical faculties are always a little ahead of our ability to produce things that will satisfy those standards. And so there's always a danger of becoming frustrated and giving up, thinking ill of oneself and one's prospects. And indeed, you know, if all one had to go on was my rough drafts, those would be justified sentiments. But patience is the thing. Be patient with yourself. It happens over time. It happens, at least in my case, it happens through the practice of the thing over and over again, and in any given story or book through many different drafts. So I have learned to be patient. Time is your enemy in almost everything in this world, but not in writing. You know, you use the gifts of time and be patient with yourself and just, you know, I guess that's the main bit of advice I would give.
Thank you very much, sir.
You bet.
Hi, thank you so much for being here. I'm curious, after your talk tonight and the setting that you came from in Washington State, if I heard correctly, and maybe books weren't cherished that much. How were you inspired or prompted to even apply to a school clear across the country, a prep school? I'm just curious who, how you even knew to do that.
That's certainly a good question. It wouldn't have, you know, it wasn't the first thing that would have occurred to me. My parents split up when I, as I mentioned earlier, when I was about four. And I grew up with my mother, and on the other side of the country, I grew up mostly out in Florida and out west, mostly out west. My brother grew up with my father back east in Connecticut, and he's my brother's some years older than I am. He's about 8 years older than I am, and it was my brother's. He had a very different upbringing, and did in fact go to such a school himself, and. I, at a point of desperation in my life, tracked my brother down, and when I was about 15, I just turned 15, and described to him the problems I was having at home with my stepfather and just the general mess of my life, and he urged me to apply to these schools, and he said they gave scholarships. I hadn't known anything about that, and he gave me a list of three or four schools that I should apply to, and I did. And without going too deeply into that, in the end, I was able to go to one. But that's how the idea occurred to me.
And interestingly enough, for those who don't know his life story, his brother Jeffrey Wolfe is also a writer.
He sure is.
Yeah,
absolutely.
And wrote a memoir about your father, right?
Yep. It's called The Duke of Deception. It's
the
a
Duke
wonderful
of
book.
Deception.
Wonderful
so.
Book.
Tobias, I'm coming to the microphone a little embarrassed because I find myself in a room full of your fans, and today I discovered you for the first time. My question to you is that I am a Kindle owner, and I was just wondering if you have any books on Kindle, and if not, what kind of information can you give me now at this time about Kindle?
What could I don't have a lot of information about it. Somebody gave me one about 8 months ago, a Kindle, and I've got a couple of books on it, and I have yet to read them. and I think it's, I just naturally reach for a book. That's who I am. I just reach for a book. But I think they're great instruments, really. But
do you have any of your books on Kindle?
Yeah, you can get some of my books on Kindle.
Are they okay? Mm-hmm. Because I read two or three books at the same time, so it would be nice to have them all in one place instead of in every other rooms in the house.
Yeah, no. I approve completely of the Kindle, but I just don't use it myself, even though I own one. And they're really cool. I mean, I love the type, the font. I like the fact that you can adjust it. My brother, who you just mentioned, only reads now on the Kindle because he's nearsighted and he can make the font to his taste. Mm-hmm. And I think it's a real... I mean, I love the idea of somebody in a backwater like the one I grew up in, for example, in Washington State, with this new Kindle that's just come out now, that holds 3,500 books. So a kid in some rural area can have a library of thousands of books. What an amazing thing that is! No, I'm completely in favor of it. I just don't use it.
Well, thank you very much. I bought your book tonight, but I'm going to be looking at. Getting some of them on my Kindle.
Good.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Hi, Mr. Wolfe. One of your short stories that has always really struck me was Mortals. And ever since I read that, I always kind of wondered, if you were to submit your own obituary like the gentleman in Mortals, what would it sound like?
I have a short story called Mortals, in which a guy on a newspaper has been writing obituaries, and someone snookers him by sending in a death notice on a man who actually isn't dead. And it does raise that question. Boy, I'm going to leave the answer to that to other people. I'm superstitious. If I there's something about writing your own obituary that's very ominous, and I am not going to accept that invitation.
Hi, Mr. Wolf. I teach at an all-girls school here in town. This has been my first year, so to read old school and to have that experience has been a study in contrast, I guess. And so I'm kind of curious about the character of Susan Friedman and what you had in mind when you were writing her.
Well, may I ask, first of all, are your students, even though the milieu of this of the book is at a boys' school, are they able to respond to that?
We haven't read the book together as a class, but I would say that we probably have some of the same class issues, maybe at times.
Yeah. Okay. I would hope so. I mean, well, I would hope not, but I would hope that the world is recognizable no matter the milieu. Well, I think, the fact that he resorts, here he is in this all-male school that exalts the virtues of masculinity, and he actually takes a story from a girl's life and uses that, and nobody knows the difference, including Hemingway. I just thought that said something about, the commonality of our natures. And, I know there are things obviously peculiar to the life of a boy as opposed to the life of a girl, but underlying it, these same anxieties and resentments and worries and so all that stuff that the boy was worried about, his life story, his story was in that story that she wrote. And just by changing a few things, he turned it into his story, and nobody could even tell the difference. And so, I don't know, much is made of that, and I was just having a little fun with that notion. He could have plagiarized this story from somebody writing it in a boys' school magazine, right? It would have been very different then. But I really wanted to have the pleasure of him, first of all, recognizing his experience in the life of a woman and of a girl, and that others couldn't see that there was any difference either. Anyway, that was why I did it that way.
What about the interaction between the two when they meet? What was kind of your...
Yeah, well, the interaction between the two... Well, he imagines, since they have so much in common, that she's older than he, of course. She's a few years older than he. And he imagines that, maybe some romance might happen. They actually have some experience in common. They've written the same story. and, in fact, shared the same story, truly, in some ways. And, he discovers a very substantial person. She's in medical school. That mother who is so sick in the story is not feeling well, and the story turns out to have died later, and that she has gone back to take care of her sister, and her mother, and then her sister when her mother dies, and then has gone on to Georgetown Medical School, and she treats him in a big sisterly way, and again, one of his fantasies is meets reality, it has a little bittersweet taste, I think, that encounter with her. But she is not deliberately, but there's a certain condescension, such as one has with a younger sibling almost. And so I had some fun writing that scene.
You have fun a lot, and you'll have those little turns, like at the point where he tells her, you should keep writing, and she goes, don't think so, too frivolous. Know what I mean? It just cuts you off and makes you selfish and doesn't really do any good.
Which is what every writer worries about.
Hello, Mr. Wolf. I teach high school English, and I was curious... you talk about the agony of getting the draft out to a certain degree, and then the joy of the actual writing process, of the editing process, and that's something that my students, just the joy of playing with words, trying to get that across to them. and giving them that there's a sense of hope to their writing, that something hopefully will come out of it.
Yeah.
How long does it usually take, from the point where you conceive an idea and start to pen it and get it down into paper, how long does it usually take you and you know, how long does the process take for you, for the average story, or what does it usually look like?
Well, I usually spend at least a couple of months on a short story, and I resign myself to that at the beginning of the process. I figure, well, the story will probably take, you know, I have written stories that took less time than that I've gotten lucky with, but most of the time it'll take me a couple of months, and it's taken me as long as 4 or 5 months to, there's a story in this new collection of mine, Our Story Begins, a story called Deep Kiss that really took me many months, and then it still wasn't right, and I put it aside for several years, and then came back to it, and then I finally think I understood what it was about, and was able to finish the story. I knew I'd finish it someday. I thought there was something important that I needed to get at in there, but it took me a while to figure it out. So each story behaves a little differently. The one thing I know is that I'm going to be living in it for a while. Hmm. Friends of mine, I mean, Joyce Carol Oates is a friend of mine, and she really writes much differently than I do. And I'm not saying this in kind of fake humility. She's, I think, a lot smarter than I am, and she manages and more, I don't know, she's able to write stories in her mind very quickly, I think. And she has some classic stories. I mean, Where Are You Going? Where Have You Been? Stalking. How I Viewed the World from the Detroit House of Correction. She's written some truly great stories, but she writes very quickly. And so, again, this is an example of how different people can be in their work habits. The fact that you write quickly doesn't mean you're going to write less well. If you can really work things out in your mind and you're happy doing that, some of us just need to get our hands in the stuff and mess around with it for a while.
Is there another novel in the making somewhere in there?
I hope so.
Okay, I think we have last question.
A couple of weeks ago, there was a big read event where a panel of three experts, one on Hemingway and Ayn Rand and Frost and Hemingway and...
I wish I could have been there. I would love to have been there.
But Hemingway expert and the Frost expert agreed that everything that you'd put in the book was right on, but the Ayn Rand expert was extremely disturbed. And
they are always extremely disturbed. That's not even a movement, it's a religion.
And I think the question from him, as well as everybody in the audience in the panel, was, why did she get treated such?
I was easy on her. Okay, let's go into this a bit. Here's a woman who Here's a woman who, when asked, what was the biggest mistake you ever made, replied, I have never made a mistake. I have always acted rationally, and therefore I have never made a mistake. If things went wrong, it was because somebody else did. She also said that she never owed anybody anything, that no one had ever helped her. And if you read her biography, you know that's not true. She was helped when she came here from Russia as a girl. She lived on the generosity of other people in this country. It was essential to her creed and to her sense of herself to believe that everything she had ever done, she had done without anybody helping at all, because the minute you admit that we are passed from kindness to kindness in this world, the whole thing, the whole virtue of selfishness philosophy completely falls apart. And if you really would like to know more about her, I suggest that you read, for example, Judgment Day, which is his still somewhat loving account of her by a man named Nathaniel Brandon, who founded the Whole Objectivist Society to celebrate her work and was her lover. She took him as her lover when she was in her late 50s and he was about 25 and married, and created havoc in his life. And Judgment Day refers to the day he finally told her that he wasn't going to be her lover anymore, and it was a complete meltdown. He at first, when he had the meetings of this Objectivist Society, used to invite her to speak at those meetings. Then he stopped, because if anybody said anything that gave away the fact that they had not almost memorized every word she'd ever written, she would come down on them with such cruelty that she was alienating the very people who were her acolytes. So she was very ungracious to people. And when she gave talks, she could be very, very hard. And she was a really smart woman. I mean, and she had some things I think were right. There was, I think, undoubtedly a certain romance among the left in this country about communism and an unwillingness to see what was actually being done in the countries that embraced it out of some feeling of solidarity. And she, I think, quite rightly was alarmed about that fantasy of the perfect world, the utopian world that was just a, I mean, she had seen it firsthand herself. She had seen the executions that followed the revolution in Russia, and 17 professors of hers at the university were killed, so many of them, indeed, that after a while they were renting coffins to take them to the graveyard and dump them into holes. She saw a lot, and she had some things to say, but she was an interesting example to me of this case that when you become obsessed with fighting an evil, if you shape your whole life to that, you can begin to become a mirror image of that. Your obsession will lead you to take on the very characteristics of that thing which you obsessively oppose. And I think she did after a while. She was heated and shrill and unreasonable and an absolutist. The absolutist philosophy, it doesn't make for friendly people. And so
you did go easy.
But I read a lot in presenting that picture of her. I was quite fair. And indeed, one thing that is absolutely true, she thought all contemporary writers were horrible, except for one, Mickey Spillane. And she liked Mickey Spillane because Mike Hammer just shot people when they were bad. There was none of this going to the juries. Remember, I, the Jury, that's one of his novels. Get it over with. She liked that.
Tobias Wolff, his collection of short stories, by the way, is called Our Story Begins, New and Selected Stories, and it really does span his career of short stories. So, thank you.
Well, thank you, Angela, and thank all of you.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Tobias Wolff. Thank you, Angela Elam.